Today on Spiritually Hungry, we welcome Charles Duhigg. He is a Pulitzer Prize winning author. He has authored the book, The Power of Habit, which spent over 3 years on the New York Times bestseller list. He's also written Smarter, Faster, Better, which was also on the New York Times bestseller list. And his latest book, Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection, is available. And today we are going to talk about so many fascinating things. He gives us many tips, tools on how the brain works, how to form a habit, how to break a habit. So join us today and let's welcome Charles. So first, I think we want to talk about your first book. And when we talk about habits, I think a lot of people think that they're either disciplined or they're not. Some have a strong willpower or they don't. And that breaking bad habits is especially hard. And people kind of get stuck on how to create new healthy habits. So first, can you tell us about the science of habits?
Sure. Yeah. So for the last decade or so, we've been living through this golden age of understanding the science of habit formation. And one of the big insights is that we tend to think of a habit as being just this one thing, right? The behavior. But actually, every habit has three parts. There's a cue, which is like a trigger for an automatic behavior. And then the routine, which is the behavior itself, what we tend to focus on. And then finally, a reward. Every habit in your life delivers a reward to you, whether you're aware of it or not. And about 40 to 45% of what you do every day is a habit. And what we figured out is that when we talk about creating a habit or breaking a habit, we really tend to focus on that behavior, right? On the routine. But the cue and the reward give us the strongest leverage points for making changes. If we can diagnose what the cue and the reward are for a particular behavior, then we can start to get underneath the hood and fiddle with the gears. And that makes change a lot easier.
So can you give me an example of both how that would work, what, let's say, with the negative habit that we have, right? Because there's still a reward there. Mostly we're not conscious of that. But even if you're doing it over and over again, you are getting some kind of pleasure from it, even if it's not good for
you. Let's take smoking, for instance, right? So what we know from a medical perspective is that if someone has smoked for a while and they give up cigarettes, 100 hours after their last cigarette, the nicotine is out of their blood system. They are no longer physically addicted to nicotine. And yet we all know people who 5 or 10 or 15 years after they gave up smoking, they still crave a cigarette with their morning coffee, or they still crave a cigarette at 10 o'clock in the morning or 2 in the afternoon. That's not because of a physical addiction. That's because of a habit dysfunction. It's a habit that exists in their brain. There's a part of our brain known as the basal ganglia that exists simply to create habits. And what it does is it ties that cue, routine, reward together in a neural loop. And that neurology remains with us forever. So what do you do? What do you do when you still are having that craving for a cigarette, or when you're trying to quit smoking in the first place? Well, the first thing to do is to identify the cue, right? And cues usually fit into one of five categories. It's usually a time of day, a particular place, the presence of certain other people, a certain emotion, or a preceding behavior that becomes ritualized. So if you're someone who 10:30 every morning, you crave a cigarette, we know what your cue is, right? Your cue is that it's a time of day. And it might actually be that you have this craving when you're at work, but you don't have it when you're at work. So the cue might also be a certain place. So, okay, what do you do? That's the cue. What's the routine? Well, the routine is I stand up from my desk, I go outside, I take out my cigs, I talk to a couple of other people, I smoke, then I go back inside. Okay, we know what the behavior is. Now, what's the reward? And figuring out the reward can be kind of hard. It can take a little bit of experimentation. Because for someone at that 10 o'clock routine, that 10 o'clock habit, it could very well be that the reward is the cigarette itself. Maybe you're getting a burst of energy from that cigarette. It could also be that the reward is that you get to go out, you get to take a break from work, that you need something to break up your day. Could be that when you go outside and you talk to someone, that bit of socialization feels really, really satisfying and it feels restorative to you. The only way we're going to figure out what the reward actually is to conduct experiments. So tomorrow at 10 o'clock, when you feel that urge, what you should do is go ahead and go outside before you have a cigarette. Instead of having a cigarette, have a double espresso, right? Something that's going to give you an energy burst, kind of similar to what nicotine provides for you. And then go back to your desk and ask yourself, Am I still craving that cigarette? Do I still feel this hunger for it? Then the next day, go out, have your cigarette. Don't talk to anyone. Test whether the social element of this is the reward. The next day, go ahead and have a cigarette, but instead of taking a break, smoke as fast as you humanly can. Get back to your desk. Don't give yourself any time to relax. What we're trying to do is we're trying to conduct these experiments to figure out, what kind of reward am I craving? What can I do instead of smoking that seems to satisfy this desire that's at the core of the neural loop of the habit? And once you figure that out, you can change the habit.
And how long does it normally take once you've found the right cue and the right reward to change, to then change that habit?
I mean, it depends from person to person and habit to habit. If you want to create a habit that involves eating chocolate, you can probably do it in a day. If you want to create a habit that involves, you know, running marathons, might take a little bit longer. But what is true is that because of how our neurology develops, every single day that you do something new in a stable relationship of cue, routine, and reward, the new neural threads connecting those three elements become thicker and thicker and thicker, which means that pulses can move along them faster. So it's going to be easier on day three than it was on day one. It's going to be much easier on day 10 than it was on day three. When do you reach that point when it just becomes easy and you do it thoughtlessly? I don't know. And nobody else does either. But it will get easier and easier and easier when you keep that habit loop stable.
And a person has to really want this, right? Because we talk about willpower. There's been a lot of different thought around that. Some say, you know, you have more willpower in the morning. Then there were other studies that actually that's not the case.
So willpower and habits actually are the opposite ends of a spectrum. So a habit is something that actually takes no willpower. It's a behavior that becomes thoughtless, right? A habit is something that we choose to do initially, and that takes some willpower to choose to do. But eventually we begin acting on that choice without making it. We stop making a choice, but we continue acting on it. And so you're exactly right that one of the things that we know about willpower is that willpower can be strengthened, it can be weakened. A lot of it has to do with how we learn to deploy willpower, how we structure the environment to make willpower easier or less easy. But the answer is that you need to use willpower initially to make a change. But then if you do it correctly, you need to use less and less willpower to maintain that change. And the thing that's important is there is no such thing as a good habit or a bad habit, right? Your brain will turn anything it can into a habit because our brain is a cognitive miser. It wants to conserve energy as much as possible. It's that you decide that some habits are healthy or unhealthy. You decide some habits are things you want to encourage or discourage. And that's, of course, the first important step is to be honest with yourself. Look, I like to have a cocktail once or twice a week. Like, for some people, that's a bad habit. For me, it's something I enjoy. I don't see it as a bad habit. And so I don't feel like I have to change it. And I think it's more about understanding your own desire.
Yeah, what I found very instructive was you bring the Anne Grabiel, who's done the research around the rats, and what she found out, which I think was counterintuitive, right, to what we might have thought about habits.
So what Dr. Grabiel figured out was that by studying rats' neurology as they run through a maze, that she was able to see that as the rat got faster and faster and faster at solving the maze, it was thinking less and less and less. And this is what we know about the neural signature of a habit. A habit, as I mentioned, is a decision we make, and then we stop making the choice and continue acting on it. It's because we're actually thinking less and less and less. When you are in the grip of a habit, when you are walking into that cafeteria and this morning you said, I want to have a salad because it's healthy, and you walk into that cafeteria and you go over and you pick up that hamburger instead, it's not because you're making a choice. It's because you're literally not thinking. It's very easy to just follow your instinct and not think about it. If you can interrupt it, if you can take a second and you can say, actually, wait, like, I remember I'm going to have a salad, you'll go get that salad. And so the key is to identify those habits and try and figure out, how do we change them?
Exactly. So I have to say, I was fascinated by all of your work, but maybe you can share with our listeners what awakened you the desire to go from something like habits and then your second book and now to communication.
Yeah. So I wrote Power of Habit about 10 years ago, and it really came from a personal place, right? Like, I was, I basically was like, if I'm so smart and so talented, why is it so hard for me to exercise more and to eat more healthily? And I wanted to call up experts and ask them how to get better at this. And then something similar happened with communication, where I fell into this pattern with my wife, which I'm assuming is familiar to you and to anyone listening. I would come home from work after a long day and I'd complain about my day. And my wife would offer me this really good advice. She would say, like, you know, why don't you take your boss out to lunch and you guys can get to know each other better? And instead of being able to hear her advice, I would get even more upset. And I would, you know, complain and say, like, why aren't you supporting me? Why aren't you on my side? You should be outraged on my behalf. She would get upset because I was criticizing her for giving me perfectly good advice. And so very similarly, I just wanted to call up experts and say to them, look, I'm a professional communicator. Why is this happening? And what they said when I called them was, well, look, we figured this thing out about communication, and really because of advances in neural imaging and data collection. And what we figured out is we tend to think of a discussion as being about one thing, right? We're talking about habits, or we're talking about our day, or we're talking about where to go on vacation next year. But actually, every discussion is made up of different kinds of conversations. And in general, those different kinds of conversations, they fall into one of three buckets. There's these practical conversations where we're making plans and we're solving problems. Then there's emotional conversations where I tell you what I'm feeling and I don't want you to solve my feelings. I want you to empathize. I want you to show me that you've heard what I say. And then there's social conversations, which is about how we relate to each other and we relate to society, the social identities that are important to us. And what they said is, what we figured out from neural imaging is that if you are having different kinds of conversations at the same moment, you can't really hear each other. Even if both of those conversations are totally legitimate. In my case, I was coming home and I was having an emotional conversation and my wife was having a practical conversation. And those are both fine, great conversations. But because we weren't having the same kind of conversation at the same moment, we could not hear each other. We could not fully connect. And this has become known as what's known as the matching principle in psychology, which says successful communication requires having the same kind of conversation at the same time. And once we learn how to align with someone, once we learn how to match them and invite them to match us, then we can move from emotional to social to practical back to emotional together, and we can fully hear each other.
Right. And the phrase, I think, is neurally entrained, right? When you're
That's right.
In sync. And to be neurally entrained, you don't actually have to be agreeing, right? You just have to be having the same conversation.
You don't have to be agreeing at all. So what neural entrainment is that when you're in a conversation, as we are now, our bodies begin to match each other. Our heart rates start to match. Our breath rates start to match. We're not aware of this, but this is actually happening as we're talking to each other. And most importantly, our brain activity starts to match each other, right? That's amazing, right? If I describe an emotion to you, you actually experience that emotion a little bit. If I describe an idea, you experience that idea. That's known as neural entrainment. It's at the core of communication. But if I'm in an emotional mindset and having an emotional conversation, and I'm using the amygdala and the deep interior structures of my brain, and you're having a practical conversation, you're using the prefrontal cortex, what's behind our forehead, it's very hard for us to become entrained because we're literally using different parts of our brains. And so it's this alignment, this matching each other that allows us to become entrained.
Now, obviously, that's probably easier now with your wife, right? Before you're having certain conversations, you probably make sure that you're on the same wavelength. But what happens when you're trying to, I guess the goal has to be connection, right? But if you're speaking to somebody who you have a hard time communicating with, and maybe you have a difficult time being vulnerable with, how do you create a successful conversation there? Because not everybody's comfortable being vulnerable with somebody else, right? Let's say a coworker, and you need to get on the same page about, yeah.
Yeah, so you don't have to be vulnerable. I mean, if I'm matching you and we're both having a practical conversation, you have to believe what I'm saying and I have to believe what you're saying. And oftentimes, even an emotional conversation is not necessarily a vulnerable conversation. If you come home and you say to someone, hey, you know, I went out today and it was like, such a great day. I had so much fun today. And I really just felt like it, like, you know, just good about the world. That can be an emotional conversation without it being a vulnerable conversation. Vulnerability is very useful and important, but it's not an absolute prerequisite. Authenticity is. Mm-hmm.
So can you give an example how, having gone through these studies and written this book, your conversation with your wife, have they changed?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, when I come home and I start complaining, she often says to me, do you want me to suggest solutions or do you just want to complain? Right. You need to get this off your chest. And actually I appreciate her asking because it feels like she's listening to me. And I say like, no, this isn't that big a deal. I just want need to vent. It's not the end of the world. Right. In schools, they actually teach teachers to do this, that when a student comes up and they have something important they want to discuss, the teacher should ask them, do you want me to help you? Do you want me to hug you? Or do you want me to hear you? Which are the three kinds of conversations, right? The social, the practical, emotional, and social. And I think the reason why that's powerful is because oftentimes what we know about super communicators is that the most important thing that they do is they signal to the other person that they want to connect with them. And we often do this all the time in ways that we don't even realize, sometimes in nonverbal ways. Laughter is a good example of this. I'm certain, have laughed today during talking to each other and talking to other people. My guess is that the person you were talking to did not tell a joke. They're probably not a stand-up comedian. We know from studies that 80% of the time that we laugh, it is not in response to something funny. It is not in response to a formal attempt at humor. Rather, we laugh in a conversation to show the other person that we want to connect with them. And when they laugh back, what they're really saying is, I want to connect with you too. So one of the things that super communicators do so well is that in addition to asking a lot of questions and to asking a special kind of question known as a deep question, in addition to proving that they're listening, one of the things that they do is they show that they want to connect. Because when I show you that I want to connect with you, you become much, much more likely and much more willing to connect with me.
Maybe share with our listeners, if you can, the NASA psychiatrist who found the importance of how he found the importance of emotional intelligence in choosing the workers there.
And this draws it. So in the 1980s, NASA confronted this basic problem, which is President Reagan told them that he wanted them to build a space station and start sending astronauts into space for 6 to 12 months at a time. And the problem for NASA is that up till then, their longest missions had been about 10 days long. And the thing is that they had discovered, you can basically send anyone into space for 10 days and it's going to be fine. You could send the biggest jerk on Earth into space and for 10 days, he's going to be able to get along with everyone else. But if you send someone up for 6 to 12 months, you have people living in this tin can surrounded by vacuum together and they're not emotionally intelligent, they are going to drive each other crazy. They're going to start fighting with each other. So they say, look, we got to start finding a new kind of astronaut, an astronaut with emotional intelligence. But the problem for them is if you make it to the final rounds of an astronaut interview, you're like amazing, right? You're like handsome or beautiful. You have two PhDs. You've been a fighter pilot. You run marathons. And most importantly, you have been doing interviews your entire life. You are so good at interviewing. You know your greatest weakness. You know how to show that you're in touch with your emotions without being beholden to them. But differently, you can fake emotional intelligence really, really well. And so from NASA's perspective, they're like, look, we got to figure out who actually has emotional intelligence and who's faking it. And so they give it to this guy, the lead psychiatrist for a manned spaceflight. And he spends months trying to figure this out, and he can't figure it out. Can't figure out how to distinguish those who fake it from those who've got it. And so one night he's listening to old recordings of candidates, and he knows which of them were chosen and which of them go on to be great leaders within NASA and which of them kind of wash out. And as he's listening to these recordings, he notices that some of the candidates laugh differently than everyone else. So he comes up with a new way to interview. Now what he does is he walks into the interviewing room. The candidates sitting there waiting for him. He's carrying this big stack of papers, and as he comes in, he trips and spills them as if on accident. He's actually doing it on purpose, but it looks like an accident. And then he laughs this big boisterous laugh. He goes like, I can't believe I did that. And next he pays close attention to how the candidate reacts. Because some of the candidates, everyone knows that you're supposed to respond, right? You're supposed to laugh back. Some of the candidates will be like this, let me give you a hand with that. That's really, I'm sorry you spilled the papers. And some of the candidates would go, I'm sorry you spilled those papers. Let me give you a hand. What's going on here is that we've all been in this situation. You make one mistake and then you compound it by making a second mistake by overreacting, right? You spill papers and instead of just brushing it off, you laugh this big awkward laugh. And everyone knows what that feels like. And some people say, look, I'm just going to help you put that under the rug. I'm going to pretend like it didn't exist. And some people say, I want to make you feel comfortable here. I want to make you feel at home. I'm going to laugh the same way you laughed to make it feel like it's all right what you did. Those are the people with emotional intelligence. Just by paying attention to how people laughed, he was able to figure out which of them could actually connect with other people.
That's pretty amazing. Right? Yes. This is actually towards the end of the book, but I think it's important to hopefully inspire our listeners. You speak about why is it so important? Some people might say, okay, for my relationship with my wife, it's important communication. But why would you say it's important for almost everybody to learn to be a super communicator based on the Harvard study about really sort of being living a successful life?
Yeah. I mean, so let's just acknowledge at the outset, communication is our superpower. Right? As a species, Homo sapiens have succeeded because we can communicate with other people. And as a result, our brains have evolved to be very good at communication, to crave connection. That feeling you get after a great conversation, that's actually a product of evolution. It's a real thing that happens inside the neurotransmitters in your brain that nudges you and pushes you to connect with other people, because it's through connection that we manage to build villages and families and towns and cities and live peacefully amongst each other. And so connection and communication is really, really important. It is at the core of what has made us successful. And as you and everyone listening knows, the people who are most successful in your industry and in your company and in your life and in your social sphere are the people who can communicate well. But it's even more profound than that. You mentioned this Harvard study, the Harvard study of adult development, right? Started about 80 years ago with this goal of trying to figure out what are the characteristics that make people healthy and happy and successful, however you define success, at age 65. And so for years, they have followed thousands of people around trying to figure out what determines this. And they found there's one thing, only one thing, that can reliably predict your health, your happiness, and your success at age 65. And that is having at least a handful of close relationships at age 45. You could be the best lawyer on earth. You could be rich. You could be a genius. If you do not have a handful of close relationships at age 45, you're gonna die close to 65. You're gonna be miserable. You're gonna be contemplating suicide or self-harm. And no matter how much material success you have, you're not going to evaluate your own success very highly. But on the other hand, you could be kind of a loser. And if at 45, you have a couple of friends who you're really close to, you're going to be fine as you get older, right? It doesn't mean you're not going to be a loser. You might still be broke. But you're going to be happy. You're going to be content with being broke. And however you define success, which in this case would probably be non-financial ways, right? Probably being broke doesn't matter to you that much. You're going to be more successful because you're going to be in touch with people who make you aware of opportunities that you weren't aware of on your own. So the greatest thing that we can do for our health and our happiness and our success is we can form connections with other people. And the way that we form connections with other people is through conversation. And so learning the rules of how a conversation functions, learning how it works, that allows us to connect with other people.
It's so timely because I think today everybody's in such a rush, right? Rarely do we take the time to have the conversation, even if we're curious about somebody we've run into or the barista at Starbucks or whatever the case may be. We're on to the next thing. Our schedules were overpacked. And how do we kind of slow it down, you know, even because with phones, right, you can text, you don't actually have to have that conversation or to mirror the person you're speaking with or any of the things we've talked about. So what advice would you give to people who don't find the value? And I guess, especially for our children, I mean, we have four, so we try to instill that awareness and the importance of that. And as you're speaking, I was thinking of our oldest, he's always smiling and people love talking to him. And I think part of it is he makes people feel like, and he is genuinely interested, but it's all over his face and in his essence. So what is your advice? How do we kind of slow down to take the time to have a conversation? And you never know where it's going to lead, right? Those are like the gems I found speaking to strangers. Wait,
how old are your kids?
Our oldest is 25, 22, 21, and 11.
Okay. Okay. So it's that you've seen them through many stages. Yes. I have a 13-year-old and a 16-year-old. So, okay. So let me ask you, because, you know, raising four children, that is not without its effort, right? How do you slow down? How do you guys slow down when you're talking to each other?
Well, it's interesting too, as I read in your book, you said, you know, I'm a communicator for a living, but yet my most important relationships, I kind of wasn't really winning it. I wasn't participating, or my children would talk to me and I'd hear them and then I'd notice they wandered off, right? So I've been really aware of that with myself and my kids, because we work together, we work 24/7. And these are my most important relationships, the things I'm most proud of. So I really do try to bring myself back to being present. I look in their eyes, I hear them, I hear the want behind the words. So I never really took their communication style or lack thereof through the stages of their development seriously. I understood the role that I have and that role changes, and that when they're trying to find their autonomy, I'm going to have to be pushed away for a minute, but then they bring you back in. So I paid attention to the cues, and my desire behind everything was connection, right? I really want to connect to these souls we brought into the world. And same thing with us and our relationship. We're very emotionally intelligent. We worked hard at it. And we speak throughout the day, every day. We make time, we make each other feel important and heard.
Truly. Yeah. What about you, Michael?
Yeah, I was actually using an example, because yesterday our youngest daughter had a hip hop show recital at 6 o'clock, and I had relatively important, we'll call it, dinner at 7:30. And so the show goes from 6 to around 6:45, 6:50. And then I'm looking at my watch, like, I got to, you know, head out to the restaurant where I'm meeting a friend. And I said to myself, you know what? Take the time to connect with her after the show. 10 years from now, that'll definitely be much more important than whether you were 10 minutes late to this important meeting that you were having. And that was a conscious decision that I made, because, as Monica said, you know, we're very aware of the fact that communication is important, but the desire to connect is really what should be behind it. And I actively made that choice, as we do often in our decisions, which is, you know, those are certainly family, important relationships. Put them first, even if it has to in some way impede on other relationships that we have. And interestingly enough, and this is something else you speak about, which I really wanted to go a little bit more deeply with you into it. So I had this person last night, was the first time I ever met him. And we had about a 6-hour conversation afterwards.
I wake up at 1:30 in the morning and I'm like, where is, I'm calling him. I'm like, where are you? Because it was supposed to be a dinner at 7:30 and now it's 1:30 and I'm like, why isn't he in bed?
And we went deep. We talked about family, his relationship with his parents, business. He has a very fascinating life. He deals with, well, I won't say which South American country, sort of the leaders of that country. So he has a lot of very interesting stories, but we went deep. At the end of the evening, he says to me, it's 1 a.m. as we're getting into our Ubers, he says, you know, I've never spoken like this to anybody in my life. And I think what Monica and I try to do is prioritize connection, right? So if you're going to have a dinner with somebody, don't talk about the weather, talk about their family, talk about what is important to them.
Yeah, we always go deep.
Well, and one of the things I hear you saying, which I think, and tell me if I'm getting this wrong, but I think is important, is that you think about communication. And this is something that we know about super communicators, consistent super communicators, because we're all communicators, super communicators at one time or another. But there are some people who can do this consistently, who can connect with almost anyone. That when you ask them, have you always been good at communication? They often say things like, no, right? Like when I was in high school, I had trouble making friends. And so I really had to study how kids talk to each other. Or my parents got divorced and I was the peacemaker between them. I had to really think about what to say to my mom and what to say to my dad. What they're really saying is, there have been times in my life that I have to think about communication. Because we're so good at communication naturally, right? As humans, that there's lots of people who don't think about it. They just do it automatically. But when we start thinking about it, when we start saying to ourselves, how do I make this conversation more meaningful? Which conversations are most important to me? How do I want this conversation to unfold? What do I want to say? And equally importantly, what am I hoping that this other person talks to me about? What questions can I ask them to draw them out? What we're really doing is we are becoming super communicators simply by paying attention to how communication happens. Just paying half an inch, thinking half an inch deeper about a conversation makes the conversation much, much better.
Well, it's interesting with the examples. I remember exactly when I started to think about communication. We're three sisters in my family, and my older sister would, you know, growing up, she'd ruminate about her problems over and over again. And I would just like, oh, it's clear. Just do this. Like, here's the solution. And she would not hear me. It was like on deaf ears. And finally, I realized one day, because I always wanted to help people. So I thought, why is it that she never listens to me? Why am I not being her? How come I can't help her? Like, then I realized that I just need to learn to really listen with a desire to understand her, to hear her. And only when she would ask me, okay, I want your help. What do you think? Would I offer something? So that was the beginning of the shift, because first you have to really care in that way, to want to connect to the person and not just wait till they stop talking so then you can communicate your needs and wants.
Yeah.
Which is the issue in most, I think, especially romantic relationships.
I think that's so, right. Yes. Yeah, go ahead, Rachel.
Yeah, I was going to ask, so to our listeners who are maybe either not naturally super communicators yet or want to be deep, have the tools to deepen their conversations and relationships, what would be the top three or pieces of advice that you would give them?
Sure. And it's important to note that everyone actually is a super communicator. They're naturally a super communicator. And the best way to figure this out is, and I'll ask you guys this, if you were having a bad day and you wanted to call someone who you know would make you feel better, do you know who you would call?
Yeah.
Yeah, who is it?
I assume it would be each other.
Call each other.
It's each other. Okay. Okay.
Yes.
So that means that for each of you, the other person is a super communicator. And that you're a super communicator back. And anyone who's listening, the person who popped into your mind, they are a super communicator for you. And you're a super communicator back to them. Now, as I mentioned, there are some people who can do this with anyone. There's some people who can do this consistently. And the only difference is that they've recognized that the skills that the two of you use with each other, the skills that that best friend uses when they're talking to you to ask the right kinds of questions and to show you that they're listening, those are skills that are cross that you can use on anyone, right? They're more akin to reading than to talent. We learn to read by reading fiction. And that doesn't mean we can't read a cookbook or we can't read nonfiction or the newspaper. Once you learn the skill of reading, you can use it for anything. Communication is the same way. It's a set of skills that we can use in any setting. So what are those skills? Well, one of the skills is asking questions, right? And asking the right kinds of questions. In particular, asking deep questions. And a deep question is something that asks about your values or your beliefs or your experiences. And that can sound a little intimidating, but it's as simple as, for instance, if you meet someone who's a doctor, instead of saying, oh, where do you practice medicine? Which is the easiest thing to ask. Asking, oh, what made you decide to go to medical school? Or what do you love about the hospital you work at? Like when you ask that question, what you're really asking is, tell me who you are. Right. Tell me how you see the world. Tell me something about, and you're inviting them to say something that is revealing, that is meaningful. So asking questions is the first important skill.
Second. Number two.
you got our attention. Yeah.
So the second skill is that once you've learned how to ask those questions, you need to prove that you're listening to someone. Right. And in particular, this is true when we have what are known as conflict conversations, which means we're talking about something hard like race or politics or religion, or we disagree with each other. You're going to vote for your guy and I'm going to vote for my guy, or just we have these differences, right? That we don't see eye to eye. In those conversations, there is a sneaking suspicion in everyone's mind that the other person is not listening to us. They are merely waiting their turn to speak. And we need to overcome that suspicion by proving to them that we are in fact listening to them. Now, most of the time we think that we prove that we're listening by what we do when they're speaking, right? We nod our head, we say, interesting. But the thing is that speaking is such a cognitively intense activity, we tend not to notice how our audience is reacting when we're speaking. What matters is what they do after we finish speaking. And there's actually a technique for this. They teach at Harvard and Stanford, a bunch of other places, called looping for understanding. And it's got three steps. The first step is ask a question, right? A deep question if you can. Second step is once the person has answered that question, try and repeat back what you heard them say in your own words. And what's important here is this is not mimicry. This is not literally repeating back what you just said. Rather, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to prove to you that I was paying attention and, more important, I'm trying to prove that I was processing what you were saying, that I'm actually thinking about it, that I can add something to it. And then the third step, and this is a step everyone usually forgets, is ask if you got it right. Because one of two things is going to happen. First of all, they might say, no, you didn't understand what I was saying. And that's useful to know. But the second thing that might happen is they say to you, yeah, no, I think you got it right. And what happens in that moment is that you have asked for permission to acknowledge that you were listening. And one of the things that's interesting about our neurology and how our brains evolved is that when we believe someone is listening to us, we become more likely to listen to them in return. And so this asking if we got it right is a way of triggering that instinct within our brains.
That's very, very, very useful. And, you know, and you speak a lot about conversations.
The conflict, right?
And conflict. Yeah. So I wanted to go a little bit into that. And maybe you can share with our listeners the story of the soccer league in Iraq.
Sure. Let me ask you guys. Sure. What's a conflict that you've had that you found that you had to negotiate through?
With us? Between us?
Yeah.
So it's interesting. Every few months, because we're both very, very busy, you know, even though we try to spend as much time as we can in any given week, there comes a time, and I'll point the finger at me, where I become maybe a little bit less emotionally intelligent.
I call it quiet and vacant.
and literally what has to happen, and this usually, you know, between 3 to 6 months or so, Monica calls me in for a conversation. And we first start talking about, you know, this thing happened or that thing happened. You did this or you did that or you didn't hear this. And then at the end, it really comes down to Monica, who's a clearer communicator than I, saying, don't you understand what I'm asking for is, you know, for you to, you know, just to listen to me or to really hear me, which is crazy because we've been married for 27 years. But I know that 6 months from now, there's going to be a point at which I am not, even though I think I'm listening and hearing her, I'm not actually internalizing what she's feeling and trying to communicate with me. So it really, that's kind of the cycle, which I think is a pretty good cycle because we go pretty well for 4 to 6 months.
And then so let me ask you, what's happening there when she's saying something and you're not listening? What's occurring? Why aren't you listening?
So it could be, I think it's one of two things. Either I would call it ego, which is like, yeah, in back of my mind, yeah, you wanted me to do that, but you know, I'm still upset about this or this bothered me, right? So sort of I, within my own mind, say I don't need to listen because I have these other grievances that aren't being addressed. Or second, it's just mindfulness as an effect of just being too busy in life. So you know, I understand, you know, almost my mind doesn't compute the lack of listening because I'm so busy doing these other important things.
Yeah.
For me, I'll feel a lack of, it's more of a feeling for me. Once I start to feel that there's a little bit of a disconnect between us or I'm not feeling like I even want to connect, that's when I know it's gone too far. And that's when I usually have the conversation. So I think that when Michael gets distracted with some kind of stress outside, he gets quiet. When he gets quiet, I feel distant, right? So I've learned to see what the pattern is, and then we'll have a conversation or a few conversations.
It usually takes a few conversations for me too.
I remember there was only one time, I would say, in our relationship after we became emotionally intelligent, which took about 7 years into the marriage, that I felt like I tried to have a conversation three different times. Or twice, and he could not hear me. I just had a surgery on my foot. And so I had become very dependent on his help in every area, like to help me take a bath, to get dressed, to make my tea, because we have stairs in our house. Like for 9 months, by the way, it was a really intense surgery and recovery. And he was a saint through it all, but it took its toll in this way in the relationship. So I remember by the third time, because I knew that something had to be understood. And we always, at the end of our conversations, end up feeling closer and we laugh about it and we feel even more connected. So it's a process that we understand and I think we navigate well. But by this third time, I had driven up to our house and I said, I'm not going to the house until I feel heard. And so I called him on the phone and I sat in the car for 45 minutes and we had a conversation that way. And you did hear. You
eventually, did yes.
Hear.
Yeah. I think that, so one of the things that I'm hearing you guys say is that in your relationship, oftentimes communication becomes deprioritized by other things in life. which is normal, right? There are things beyond connecting with each other. There are things beyond communicating. And those things are important. They can take up a lot of our time and attention. And I think that the question isn't, do you have the skills to connect with each other? The question is oftentimes, is connecting with each other something that we should prioritize right now? And it's very easy to say, oh, a married couple should always prioritize connecting with each other. But the truth of the matter is, that's saying one thing is absolute, is never the right answer, right? There are definitely times when my wife and I have less time to connect than we'd like. And that doesn't mean our relationship is on the rocks. It means that we're busy with other stuff and that we're forgiving of each other. And we say, like, okay, look. And then we reach a point where one of us might say, look, we really need to reconnect, right? Like, let's do something to help us reconnect and sort of set these other things aside. And it's that thinking about communication that's really, really important and critical, and is the final skill that super communicators have, is thinking about connection and communication and showing others that they want to connect and communicate.
Well, you just made me realize something that I hadn't thought of before as you were speaking. And I think that I know we both spend a lot of time in our day, our week, like our life is being that for people, right? Listening to them, really hearing them, helping them navigate through their life. So connecting with them. And I realize that the more we are accessible in that way, it's actually, I just realized that now, the less we're doing that for each other. But we do, like you said, with you and your wife, we make the time, we make a conscious effort, but I think it used to be more effortless because it was just more about the two of us, right? So it's just an interesting epiphany I just had into why, you know, there's a shift.
So one of the reasons I was inspired by your story about the soccer league.
Going back to the soccer.
Yeah, because I'll tell you why, because we look at the world today, right? And conflict seems, you know, so large, especially I'm speaking now about what's happening between the Palestinians and Israelis, for example. It just seems so large. And we think, you know, it's either completely unsolvable ever. And I was inspired by this as, you know, maybe there's something here, or at least a seed of something that can actually be a pathway for solving conflicts, big and small.
Yeah, I think that's right. So I think that you're right that we're living through a time of polarization, right? Sort of historically. And part of that is because, you know, when our parents, for instance, were in school, they usually took a course called like Home Ec or Interpersonal Communications, something that really taught them how to think about communication. And as schools became more technical, that tended to fall out of the curriculum. The other thing is that oftentimes it's easier for us not to interact with other people who are different from us. And interacting with people who are different from us oftentimes teaches us how to have conversations with those people who are different from us. But I think the thing that is true, and this is what they found in Iraq when they did this experiment where they brought together Muslims and Christians onto soccer teams, and initially the groups didn't want to have anything to do with each other, but by changing the salience of various identity characteristics, by saying, look, in addition to being Christian, you're also the guy who brings oranges for everyone to eat. And in addition to being Muslim, you're the guy who leads the warm-up exercises before the game. Those things were more salient to the situation they were in because they helped them win, right? And they were all there to play soccer. And by emphasizing the salience of those roles and those other identities beyond Christian and Muslim, by making someone the team captain or the team cheerleader, that in doing so, what we do is we help people find a way to connect with each other. And the truth of the matter is, we do this all the time, right? We're about to have an election, and you have neighbors, I have neighbors. We have neighbors with lawn signs that say that they're voting for the other guy. And it's so easy to basically say, oh, this is the defining characteristic of you. And the truth of the matter is, you think about the presidential election like 1-2% of your day, right? Like, and you think much more about your kids. You think much more about the kids that both the schools that both your kids go to. You think about the pothole that's on your street that you and your neighbor both have to drive around every single day. There are so many other things that we share than that which divides us. And we all have this instinct to connect with our neighbor. We all want to be able to go out in our lawn, see our neighbor and be like, hey, Jim, how are you? You know, how's it going? And the fact that they have like this sign on their lawn is just sort of immaterial. We all want to connect with each other. And the more that we serve as a model, the more that we learn and think about connection and communication, the better we are at that. And I think we are returning to a world of that. I think there's a real hunger for us to come together and to be able to converse with each other.
So what you're saying is that one of the ways to at least begin to resolve these conflicts, that disagreement might still continue to exist, but that you see them in a wider lens, right? So they're not just a supporter of this person or a person from this part of the world, but rather there's much more to them. And learning that opens you up to at least, I guess, a communication and then hopefully a lack of resentment or anger towards each other, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that was very good looping for understanding, by the way. that's exactly right. That one of the things that's really important in that social conversation I mentioned is to acknowledge what we have in common and what our differences are, but do it in the context of the fact that we all contain multitudes, right? It's not that I'm Black and you're white. It's not that I'm a Jew and you're a Christian. It's that you're Black and Jewish and you work at the same office I do, and we both coach Little League together. And, you know, I also know that, like, you used to be a cop and you went to law school. You contain multitudes and I contain multitudes. And when we bring those multitudes to the table is when we are able to discuss our similarities and our differences in a way that feels restorative and feels really communion rather than like opposition.
So first of all, I was going to share that, you know, I was born in Israel. I grew up obviously with a lot of Israeli friends. I also have a lot of Palestinian friends, and it always felt true to me that one of the biggest problems, and maybe again, what you're saying in your book as well, is that seeing the other as completely other is very much at the seed of continual conflict, right? If there was Absolutely. A possibility to see the other as more as myself,
human like you,
right?
Like you.
Then there's at least an opening to actually to in the long term ending a conflict.
That's exactly right. And one of the things that happens when we do invite all those identities to the table is that the other tends to be one identity, right? If I say, look, you're the Jew and I'm a non-Jew, like, tell me what you think about Israel. Well, all of a sudden I've like pushed you into this corner, right? Like, I've defined you as being different from me. And part of you is like, well, I am a Jew, but also, like, you know what? I'm also like someone who, like, you know, has lived in Cairo, and I'm someone who's thought about this question from the Palestinian perspective. And I have Palestinian friends, and also I'm a lawyer and I'm a writer, right? All those identities, when we bring them to the table, what we're doing is we're giving you an opportunity to describe who you actually are, as opposed to reacting me trying to push you into a stereotype. And that's very, very important.
Absolutely. Thank you. So one last question I have is it's not every day you get to speak to a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. What did it feel like for you to win the Pulitzer Prize?
It was great. Yeah. I mean, honestly, like, I had been a reporter at the Times for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years at that point. Look, the truth of the matter is when you're a journalist, like, your goal isn't to win the Pulitzer Prize. It's to do work that is worthy of winning a Pulitzer Prize. And so the really rewarding aspects of that, we won the explanatory Pulitzer Prize for a series of articles about looking at the global economy through the lens of Apple and about working conditions in Chinese factories and how Apple used tax policy to avoid paying taxes. And what felt satisfying was that this work spurred change and seemed to help people understand the world a little bit better. And so winning the prize was great. I was very happy to do so, but it was the byproduct of the thing that was meaningful to me.
Thank you. I very much enjoyed your work, your books, and this conversation. To really thank you for joining us.
I really appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.